Welcome to the VBAC Home Birth Stories podcast. I'm your host, Ashley Winning. I'm a home birth, free birth guide, fear and mindset coach, podcaster, speaker, women's rights activist, and highly sensitive person. I'm a mother of three girls, and I've had two unplanned and unneeded C-sections with a special scar. I birthed our third 4.5 kilo baby at home in a free birth after not being able to access a home birth midwife. My own journey has sparked a deep passion to support women to find their strength and courage to create the pregnancy, birth, and postpartum you desire and deserve. This podcast is for women wanting to learn more about VBATs, especially home births, and professionals who want to learn more about how to support VBAC women and families. I hope you enjoy this podcast. Before we get started with this podcast episode, I wanted to let you know that this one is a very emotionally charged one. There's a lot of language and storytelling that can be very traumatic or very triggering and may bring up some past traumas or challenging situations for you. So I just would like you to make sure that you're in the space that you're ready to listen to this podcast episode. And if you're not, you can always come back to it at another stage. It might be something that you want to sit down with a cup of tea or some tissues or a journaling, you know, having some notes to journal afterwards or having somebody available that you can debrief with or have a chat with. And of course, if you need any support or anything, send me a DM on Instagram. I'm more than happy to chat with you as well. This work that we're doing is challenging work at some times. You know, growth can be so challenging, but also so healing and so makes us grow as people and individuals, but the growing period can be quite challenging. So I just want you to extend some love and kindness to yourself through this, and of course I'm sending you love and light as well. I hope you enjoy this podcast episode. Hello and welcome to another podcast episode. I'm your host, Ashley, and today we have amazing Dr. Hazel Keedle on the show. Hazel has come and joined us for the second time, which is exciting, and I've spoken to you on social media before. I feel very grateful to have you in my circle of birthing wise women. Thank you for taking the time today to chat with us. We're going to be talking about obstetric violence, which I think is, we're seeing a lot more of it in the community now, in the birth community. I'm really excited to dive in. Thank you so much for coming and sharing today.
You're welcome. I'm always happy to be here.
Awesome. Hazel's been doing such amazing work in the birth space. Probably, how long would you say now since you've been doing your PhD with the VBAC research that you were doing?
I started my research journey back about 2012 into VBAC. And then I finished my PhD in 2020, the end of 2020. And then since then, I've been on the birth experience study, which has kind of broadened it. But certainly obstetric violence and birth trauma was a thread that went through all of that.
Okay, interesting. And before that, of course, you were a midwife and a home birth midwife as well. So you've been in this space for a very long time, and very grateful to have you here sharing your wise woman knowledge and collecting the stories of other women as well and pushing that for us. So let's start with, I'm not going to introduce you so much because I think everyone knows who you are. You're a bit of a superstar now. If you haven't heard of Hazel, I will put some information in the show notes and to click to another episode. But Hazel has this amazing birth book as well. If you haven't read it, it's called, and I'm just looking around my office because I've got it here, but it's called, what is it called, Hazel? It's called VBAC.
It's called Birth After Caesarean, Your Journey to a Better Birth.
Yes, it's right here. I had it because I was actually taking notes the other day, as I always am. It's my Bible for VBAC stats, actually. So that's a book to definitely check out if you want to get stats and information on VBAC as well, that you released last year, didn't you?
Yeah, she's a year old now.
Wow, that's exciting for you as well, isn't it?
It is very exciting. It's wonderful to see. I get comments, you know, weekly from women that have used the book, and you know, and I also see the language from the book coming out into back posts now on social media, which I really love, because that shows that they've kind of absorbed it, and then, you know, then it's coming out in how they're describing their birthing experiences. So yeah, it's wonderful to see it take its own little journey now.
Oh, that's really special. I love that. So let's get started with some of these questions. First of all, I would love to know what obstetric violence is.
Okay, so the term obstetric violence is a term that can have quite a lot of different connotations. Some people are okay with the term, some people are offended by the term. And if we look back to the original meaning of the term obstetric, before we add the violence, it really does go back to the origins of the word is the person who is watching the birth or is part of the birthing experience separate to the mother. So, but in more current terms, we've got then doctors that have been called obstetricians. And so often people think obstetric violence means violence from an obstetrician, but it doesn't mean that. It's actually an internationally recognized term from the United Nations. There was a special repertoire to the United Nations that explored obstetric violence, and it recognized it as a form of gendered violence because obviously it impacts women more than anyone else, and birthing people too. So it generally, it's a form of violence during the perinatal period. I don't think it's just for labor and birth. It's any time during, you know, pregnancy, labor and birth, and postnatally. And it's a form of mistreatment, but it's from a healthcare provider. So it's something that they either did or they didn't do, and that is then a traumatic experience for the woman. We don't have, you know, it's not like a diagnosis. It's not like something you can say you had obstetric violence. Again, it's very much from the experiences of the woman to go, oh, that's what I experienced. And now that the term is becoming more widely used in Australia, then we're now seeing more women going, oh, that's actually what happened to me. So it generally means any mistreatment, which can also include neglect or lack of care from a healthcare provider, any healthcare provider, during that perinatal period.
Can we have some examples, please?
Sure. So,
Have said, yeah, because it sounds to me like it's like birth trauma. Like, we can't say you have birth trauma, but if a woman identifies as having birth trauma, it's the same as obstetric violence. Is that right?
Well, I see birth trauma. Like, there's a few different ways of understanding birth trauma as well. I do love, the original term, birth trauma is in the eye of the beholder. But we have to kind of have a bit of a broader view of birth trauma. And the way that I see it is that birth trauma is an umbrella term. So, you know, we've got this umbrella, but underneath that umbrella are lots of different experiences, and women can experience one or many of those experiences that comes under birth trauma. Now, under that umbrella, there is the physical trauma. So, you know, a severe perineal tear, for example. But then why not then a dehiscence of a cesarean wound? That's also a physical trauma, right? Then we've got a fear of losing your baby's life, or fear of losing your own life, can come under birth trauma. A loss of control, that's a very big thematic issue that comes out of the qualitative research. So a loss of control. And there can be lots of other things in there, neglect, not being listened to. But then underneath that umbrella is obstetric violence. So I think it encompasses birth trauma, but obstetric violence is particularly pervasive and damaging because it is a mistreatment done by a healthcare provider that you've potentially got trust in, who then is violent towards you. But then what does obstetric violence actually cover? That's what we looked at in our survey for the birth experience study, and we'd never asked it before in Australia. There's been obviously research on birth trauma in Australia, but to actually ask the question, did you experience obstetric violence? And we've put the definition in there as well about the mistreatment by a healthcare provider. towards you or your body. And we had a definition that we got from the UN. And then we had yes, maybe, or no, because I thought, you know, this isn't a recognized term. So people needed to be able to go into that gray zone of maybe. Then when they said yes or maybe, there was 926 women that said yes or maybe, and 626 women that left comments. So it meant that we could then define birth trauma from those 626 comments. So we went through them and we categorized them. We did something called content analysis, which puts them all into little boxes. And then we look at those boxes and we kind of pull them all together. And we ended up with three main categories. And that is, I felt dehumanized, I felt powerless, and I felt violated. So in the dehumanization, there's a lot of feeling like a number in the system, not having personalized care, not being given options or having options taken away. Again, with the powerlessness as well, there's that loss of control. There could be the hurtful language as well. And then going into the violation, that's where we saw some of the physical trauma. And we had physical trauma such as pushing, shoving, grabbing hold of breasts during a breastfeeding examination, really rough fundal rubs, so rubbing up the uterus after the baby's been born. And then we also had two that were more intimate, one being all about episiotomies, and we actually labeled that one, I beg them not to cut me. And then the other one was fingers inserted into me without my consent, because it's qualitative, so we use qualitative things, which is all about vaginal examinations. And there, women used language that we would expect to see if a woman was describing a sexual assault. And in the paper, I actually like listed all those words. And honestly, if you saw them on their own, you would think that's what a woman was describing, a sexual assault. So I also believe that vaginal examinations can be a form of sexual assault, and that is under obstetric violence. So there's quite a lot that comes under obstetric violence, but it's for the woman to kind of look at that and go, that's what I've experienced. So, you know, this is a definition that can kind of still move depending on what the woman's experienced.
Wow, that felt really heavy hearing all those things in one little snippet as well. There's a lot of heaviness to that, isn't there? A lot of experiences that women are having that quite often they're not getting a chance to talk about it. I mean, they talk about it with their circles of friends. I hear women talking about their births so many times. Like I'll go to a Macca's and have a coffee or something. There'll be like a gaggle of women sitting around talking about their births. Or even outside like a medical center recently, I heard a woman sharing their birth stories, and I had to have an induction and I had a cesarean. But there's no one kind of, outside of what you're doing and, you know, all of the amazing people in this space, giving these women a voice and actually talking about it and helping them process this. And I really hope that this term gets out there a little bit more to allow women to identify, because it's really hard for women to identify that this is mistreatment and this just isn't birthright. Like, we just think it's normal. I remember going through in the hospital system and I remember thinking, I'm having my first baby. Nobody's excited. This is really cold and clinical. We're not talking about birth. It's just very routine and processy. And it's weird because it's not very humanized. It's just so cold and clinical for a lot of us going through the public system, if you go into obstetrics at least, which is where I was.
And I think when it comes to sharing that story, there are obviously going to be things that you internalize and you don't share. Like you would choose that, you know, you might share, I had to have this, I had to have that. But then you might not say, and I had a really rough internal examination and it actually made me feel like this. Like that's the bit that you're going to edit out and you're just going to take on board and go, well, maybe every woman feels like this, and not talk about it. And you know, there is this kind of challenging time of getting it out there, you know, putting this into the spotlight, which then is going to bring up trauma in women, because there's this process of identifying. And yet, when you get through that part, and especially if you get the right help, then what you're then what you then receive can be a lot more healing. Actually having the words to identify what you went through and to realize that actually that was wrong and that yes. shouldn't have happened to you can also be very powerful. For myself, with my cesarean, I was told after my cesarean that, and I was having cesarean for breech, and I was told after my cesarean by the doctor, oh, you know, you're a great candidate for VBAC next time because you got to 8 centimeters. And I'm like, well, okay, how do you know that? Oh, because I did a vagina examination on you in theatres. And I just took that positive VBAC seed that I talk about, and I'm like, I went with that. But then working in this space, it hit me like a ton of bricks. I had an unconsented vagina examination. And it made me go through a big process. Now, some could say, well, maybe if you weren't even thinking about it, it wouldn't have hit you, but it still would have done. And it was actually impacting me. And I always had questions about it. I always felt uncomfortable about it. Something didn't seem quite right. And then when I realized what it was, you know, that was a real moment of realization, but it wasn't easy. Like, it took me to some quite dark places and some remembering of things that had happened before my pregnancy that really was quite challenging, but helped me get through the other side and then realize that's actually not okay. It's not okay yeah. to do an unconsented vaginal examination when someone can't feel it and not ask permission and then not actually even give an option. I mean, yeah. seriously, I had a tiny baby on board who was bottom down and I was 8 centimeters with all the rubbish going on around me, but I wasn't given the option just to set up or to try and attempt a vaginal breech. So, you know, like, there's a lot that goes with it. Not only was it the non-consented intimate examination that was done, but it was also then the lack of options that were given to me because it wasn't even verbalized. And that doctor never saw that as a problem, never saw it as an issue. So we couldn't be going through quite an ugly time with talking about it and identifying it, but through that we can get more healing, and then we can actually get more people to say it's not okay to do that. And when we can identify that it's not okay to do that, then as women and as clinicians we can work together to identify it. I mean, I go to conferences and webinars, and when I talk about this with clinicians, I challenge them and I tell them, well, what about this? And what about when you did this? And what about when you do this? Well, do you think that's violence? And I try and throw some things that I know I may have been part of or that I have witnessed to realize that when we have this cold clinical environment, we as clinicians are also somewhat desensitized to it.
What clinicians are you talking to? Are you able to talk to obstetricians, or are you talking mostly with midwives?
I haven't had that platform yet, but I'm always open for it. I have, I've been keynote speakers at midwifery conferences, both nationally and internationally, and even just this weekend, I'm speaking to a university in Indonesia about obstetric violence. Aww. So,
you did, yes, you did mention that. That's exciting.
Yeah, so I do, you know, like, I do speak about it and try and get it from the, you know, the clinician's point of view of what they're doing and what they can do to prevent that and how it impacts women.
How does that kind of go over for them from what you're seeing? Because obviously there's a processing after the fact, but how is it kind of receiving from what you're able to see?
Well, look, I think people that go to conferences are generally a bit more open to it, but then, you know, there is good conversations. Like, I have many people come up to me afterwards and describe situations that they were witness to, whether it was way back at the beginning of their training, if they're, you know, more mature in their years, or if it's something that they just saw as a student and they're, you know, they're fresh, the fresh eyes. But it's, again, for the clinicians, it's important to identify it so they can prevent themselves from doing it. And yeah. I say that if I can kind of suggest anything, I suggest a pause. You know, before you go to do anything, especially when we're talking about intimate vaginal examinations, you pause and your thought is, how can I make this safe for the person I'm doing this to? And then I actually explore that, you know, the sitting down at a lower level, the actually explaining what's going to happen and making boundaries and then sticking to them. Because too often I would hear examples of, especially, you know, vaginal examinations and women saying, stop. and then clinicians just saying, oh, just a little bit longer. Oh, I'm nearly there. I've just got to do this. Stop means stop.
Yeah.
Stop means you're done. Doesn't matter if you have got all the information you wanted or not. It's not your body to do that to. The woman says stop. So I look at things like that and I kind of give different scenarios. And that does help midwives to go, well, what is it that I'm doing and how can I change that practice? And if that then means they're having conversations in their departments and they might not always agree with me, but I'm basing it on data, I'm basing it on evidence. And as midwives, our standard one, we've got standards we practice by, and our standard one is to provide evidence-based care. So even if it means they're having that conversation, and then that conversation, you know, I talk a lot about planting seeds, plants that seed for anyone who is listening to it. If that then means for the next time that they go in, they stop and they think and they go, how can I make this safe? Then this is going to benefit women into the future.
Yeah. How could it not plant a seed? You know, you'd just be, oh, how am I going to make somebody feel? Just take over. I imagine for many people it would take over, and many people it might take a few little seeds to be planted because we're all different, obviously. So interesting. I always wonder what kind of goes on in the back end, because I don't get to see what goes on in there. And I think about like the movement with understanding consent when it comes to sex, and you know, that everyone learning about, you know, men learning about that and women learning that we can say no, and even if we say yes, we can change our mind. And I see that that's been like changing through time. Maybe the last 10 years it's kind of had a big impact. And then it's so interesting that in a medical based environment, that it was that they've felt that they've had the authority over women's bodies. But I know that that's been like that for a very long time. But as human beings, we're kind of raising our children and treating people that we know we're not allowed to touch people. We've got a one punch kills policy with fighting and all this stuff. It's so interesting that in our society, that's not acceptable. Those things are not acceptable. But then when it comes to like women in a vulnerable state, giving birth, that people can go into that workspace and that information doesn't follow through. It's like, how does that all not link together for humans in a way?
I know it does completely dumbfound me. And, you know, I've worked in hospitals as a nurse and then a midwife since I was 18 years old, and I'm now. So I've seen it, and I think in maternity, try to complicate things in the fact that there's this baby and we've got to get this baby out, and nobody wants this baby to have a poor outcome. So we can get this baby out at regardless of what happens to the woman. And certainly some of the comments showed that. I was just looking at a couple of the comments because I was preparing for my presentation at the weekend, and one of them was, I felt just like a vessel. You know, it's almost as if at that point, you know, your main job is to get this baby out healthy, and we've got the responsibility for that. So if that means I've got to do these things to you, your consent doesn't kind of matter. Legally, it does. And legally, that baby is not considered to have rights until it has been born and is breathing. So it's a challenge, because there's that, yes, but we've got to save the baby. And what, you know, we're going to get into trouble. I could get sued. Yeah. I could get, all these things could happen because I haven't acted quick enough. But then what are they doing to women who are going to be the ones that go home and care for that baby, who are going to be the mothers, who are bringing up this generation? And I think it's very confusing for our young women coming through, because, yes, we have got so much better at consent training. I've got two teenagers in high school. I've seen three others go through high school too, but the two current ones, you know, they talk about it a lot. They really know about it. Like, I sit down, like, I'm just, for them, they've got a midwife mom, and I'm like, talk about everything with them. And they're like, oh, mom, we know about that. We've seen the tea video about consent. And they get it. And then I think, well, hang on, these young women and men then come into maternity, and it's like, what, you're just meant to ignore all that? Like, it's confusing for people. Like, I think that's really confusing. So my body is my body, and I now need to have affirmative consent when it comes to sex. Like, I've got to, like, yes, but really mean yes.
Yeah.
But then I can say, no, please stop doing that, and no one will listen to me when I'm having a baby. And so, like as Hannah said in the first day of that inquiry, you know, no means no unless you're having a baby. And yeah, you know, this is a Me Too movement, and we've got to talk about it. And it's uncomfortable. It is going to, you know, some women are going to go through some trauma from even recognizing the fact that they experienced this. But then we did that happened in Me Too too, and look what happened. You know, there has been a lot of positive changes that happened during the Me Too movement, and women now feel that we can call it out much quicker and much earlier. And we've got to do that in the maternity space too, because I think also our clinicians, our midwives and our doctors, you know, they don't go into their training with the aim to cause violence.
No.
And they don't go into their daily work wanting to do that.
Yeah.
But potentially they're not seeing it. Potentially there's so much that's going on, and so much with, you know, short staff, or you know, the responsibilities or the protocols and the policies that you must follow to the letter, that then desensitize. I almost kind of put this fog in front of people that they can't see what they're doing. And it's also what they're seeing being modeled to them. So they're seeing this is what is always being done. And it's hard to have that critical thinking to sit back and go, actually, that's kind of not okay. And we can do it a different way. And that's where I think this movement is so important, that we can actually go, no, we can do it differently. We can so do it differently. We can do this differently from the legal framework. We can do this differently by listening to women, by using trauma-informed care principles, and by actually changing practice. I don't think we can just blame the system for everything, because the system is the people.
Yeah.
And so there has to be some individual reflection on what am I doing? But then hopefully there's enough of those people saying, what am I doing? And that it will make a change.
I think I'm just having a thought process now, as I remember my experience where I had my retained placenta manually removed, and I was screaming in pain, and they continued to do it. And then after three attempts, I said, I no longer consent, and I want to be put under. And I was able to advocate for that because I understood what to say. If they were to have a conversation before that and say, look, this is going to be very painful, these are some of the options we can try after if this isn't successful. At any time, if this is too much, please let me know and we can stop. You need to consent to this. Like, that's a simple conversation that would take less than a minute to kind of have. And every single step of the way, that would be easy to implement in a non-truly emergency situation. And while that was quite emergent, we had space to have a one-minute conversation. And in probably majority of cases, women do have space to probably have a 30-second or one-minute conversation, or have those conversations in pregnancy, that these are your choices. I was speaking briefly with an obstetrician on a social media platform recently, and she was talking to all these other people defending herself, and she seemed very open-minded. An obstetrician, of course, open-minded for an obstetrician, but there was a lot of language of, it is my responsibility when the baby's born, of bad outcomes, of good outcomes, because they really are having to take that responsibility because they are getting sued, or they've got that in the back of their mind. And women are now starting to understand that, you know, clinicians have that in the back of their mind. You being a midwife yourself, and I work with a lot of women who have felt sabotage or had these experiences, how can they kind of build trust and know that people can be working in a way that they care about the woman, or they're worrying about the woman above themselves in a way? Do you think that that's part of informed consent, of having these conversations before in respectful care, showing them that we're part of this together, we're working together, we're getting your consent every step of the way, and you're allowed to withdraw your consent? Do you think that that would build the
trust? Absolutely, because, you know, there's some thoughts that, you know, women should know everything that could go wrong. Well, you can't be doing that in pregnancy. One, you'd scare the life out of absolutely everyone, but you just can't guarantee it. You know, and the more you think about a bad outcome, maybe the more likely it's going to happen. But it's not that. It's not about having to know all the terrible things that could happen. And a retained placenta is pretty rare, right? So it's not as if you've got to go through all that. But what needs to be spoken about is sometimes things might not go to plan. Sometimes emergencies happen. And in that scenario, if that does happen, these are the steps. You know, we will have we'll speak to you about it. We're using the BRAIN acronym. Like, we'll tell you the benefits and the risks to it, and what happens if we do nothing. We will tell you about that as well. You've got to know all those different options, because that's not an informed consent unless you do.
Yeah.
Like, if you don't know what could happen if they didn't remove your placenta, then how can you consent for them to remove it?
Yeah.
Like, you've got to know both sides of the argument to make that informed. Because if that's not informed, like if they say something like, if you don't let us do this right now, you will die. Well, that's just coercion. That's not based on facts. You know, you might end up with sepsis and you could get really poorly, but, you know, like, let's have a look at that doesn't equate that you're going to die in the next 5 minutes. So, you know, there is time to go through that, the benefits and the risks and the alternatives, like what happens if we do nothing, and then to have the boundaries. There should always be boundaries of, now we can try this here right now in labor ward with you, and it's not going to be comfortable, and we'll give you the gas and you can try it like this. But if it does not work and it is too uncomfortable for you, then we will stop. And the option then is that we will go to theater and you can ultimately make that decision. Like, that's giving more informed consent. But then if they then were doing the manual, I'm sorry to use that as an example, but it's actually a really, really good example, isn't it? Like, they're then doing a manual removal, and originally you had said, oh no, I want to do it manually, I really don't want to go to theatres. But then in the middle of it, you're like, I can't deal with this pain, you need to stop. And then they're like, yeah, but you said you didn't want to go to theatres, so you just have to put up with it so I can take it out. That becomes obstetric violence, even if they did a beautiful informed consent to begin with. But we're not seeing the informed consent process being done. We're not seeing the boundaries being set, and we're not seeing women receiving respectful maternity care. But there are some places where we are seeing it. And certainly because our study was so large, we can then have a look at the birth trauma and obstetric violence rates, and also the mistreatment score, which we should touch on in this interview, and compare them across the different models of care. So we've compared it across fragmented care, which is the standard care that most women in Australia receive. We compared it to GP shared care. We compared it to private obstetric, continued care with a midwife in a public system, and privately practicing midwife. Now, if it had nothing to do with model of care, it would all be the same, right? There'd be no changes.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that in the fragmented models of fragmented and GP shared care, which is basically fragmented because once they get too far along pregnancy, they're going to go into the fragmented model for labor and birth and the immediate postnatal period. They had higher rates of birth trauma, mistreatment, and obstetric violence. And in the continuity models, they had lower rates, and then they lowered the most when there was privately practicing midwifery care. Now, that was, we haven't done the full statistics logistic regressions. I'll just have to put that out for any of the stats people who are listening. That was just a descriptive statistics. The pattern is so obvious. I think it will work out. And actually, when we have done the logistic regressions, the preliminary stuff that we have done, we're not seeing any difference. We're seeing that still happens. And what we mean by that is checking the, you know, taking out things like risk, high risk status, and all that kind of stuff. So we're looking at a level playing field.
Okay.
So at the end of the day, like, obstetric violence, like, those rates can decrease, and they can decrease in those relationship based models of care. And I think at that point, we need to look at, well, what is a relationship based model of care? Well, when you know the woman really well, when you've built up that trust, and she's got that trust in you, and you trust her, then it's very difficult to be obstetrically violent. I think, you know, you are more likely to have discussed, if things happen, this is kind of the communication that we will have. And then when an emergency may occur, there's a lot of trust that the woman knows that the midwife or the doctor wouldn't be doing something unless it was really necessary. But then there's also you're ensuring that that communication has happened. Yeah. Doesn't always happen. Those rates don't go down to zero, but they do decrease. So if we can see anything that decreases the obstetric balance rates, then we know that there are things that we can improve on.
That makes sense. People can be invested when they know you, when you've got a relationship with them, they can see you more as a human, treat you better. Yes, yeah. That makes complete sense. So informed consent, like I've got this thing where like I don't feel like there's a lot of informed consent. I feel like for many women, for me, I feel like I was a bit set up when I went into the hospital system because I trusted and believed that there was this thing called informed consent and that we're going to discuss it and then you're going to agree with me because it's my choice at the end of the day. And I've shown you that I'm an educated woman who understands the risks. And that doesn't seem to happen for a lot of women. So what do you do when they then turn the conversation to, or they don't provide you with the full plethora of information that they should be I just find it as a fundamental human basic right that why are they not being held accountable for, I almost feel like it's criminal that they're not giving women, these are the options, these are the risks, let's discuss your unique situation, what do you feel? How is that not, you know, something that's really like a red siren going off in the system?
Well, I don't actually know. Like, why the hell are they not doing it? I don't get it. I don't get it.
Because so they've got the signs. It's informed consent.
In the middle of an emergency, or, you know, there's been enough of an understanding that, mind you, I've done that in emergencies too, while I'm trying to get trying to assist a woman to have a baby through a shoulder dystocia and actually explaining what I'm doing. I'm now, is it okay if I put my hands inside you? I need to do it because of this. And then going through those steps and then talking about it afterwards and going through it in detail. This is why this happened. This is why this happened. Like, we've got room for it. Why don't we do it? I can't answer that question. I don't get it. We should. Yeah. All doctors should be doing it. All midwives should be doing it. There is an argument that sometimes in an emergency it can't be done. But it's very few times that you have that kind of true emergency. And even then, even when you're running down the corridor with a woman on the bed to go to theatres, that's an opportunity to have a conversation.
Yeah.
You know, there's still going to be a little bit of a delay while she's getting cannulas in or while she's getting prepped for theatres, while everyone else is washing their hands. That someone can be having a chat about how are you going right now? Do you understand what's being done? Have you got questions about this? Can I explain to you what's going to happen next? And they have to sign consent forms anyway. So it's actually a legal requirement that when you're signing a consent form for that, for a cesarean, that the person that does fully understand what's going through. So I don't really get it, but I do think sometimes the opinion is, well, you know, I know better than you, so I'm just going to make that decision and I will use coercion instead. And use language where there is no other options. And the other options might not make any sense to anyone.
Yeah.
But they're still options. You know, you could explain, if I don't help your baby out right now, what's happened is the shoulder's got trapped onto the pubic bone. It's like a bone-on-bone thing. It's rare, but when it happens, like we do have to get the baby out really quickly. I've got maneuvers I need to do. I need to put my hands inside of you to do those. This might not be comfortable, but this is actually quite an emergent situation. Is that okay? Like, you can say that really quickly. And then to say, well, what would happen? Well, if we can't get your baby out, you know, this is a problem because, you know, this is a bone-on-bone situation and this is actually quite an emergency. And usually, like, you know, women are not dumb. This is the other thing that really annoys me, is this infantilizing of women, and to think that women don't get stuff, because they do. They absolutely do understand, and understand when there's honesty, and understand when there's, when they're being given the options in an honest way. They get it. Women are able to do that, even if they don't know all the language. Obviously, it's a challenge for our more vulnerable women. And, you know, certainly when it comes to language, the people who don't speak the same language or understand it are going to be a bit more challenging. But it's not only women who don't speak the language of the clinician that are having an issue.
Yeah.
all women are. So just across the board, we're not great at it. And we're also in a situation, you know, it is a patriarchal system. Continuity of care can topple that patriarchy to an extent. But we, as women, we're right down the bottom of that. So then to turn around and actually, sometimes we'll say, well, you could just say no. But could you really say no when you've been brought up to have respect for these individuals or for this profession, and they are trusted and they're there to help you, and then it's scary and you want to have your baby in your arms, and it is a very scary situation. Are you then really able to, when you're right down the bottom, to actually turn around and go, oh, could you just tell me what happens if I don't do this? Or could you just give me a bit more information? That's we shouldn't be putting that on women. That's too hard. Some women can, and that's great. And we will generally find they are probably white, middle class, and well educated, and they might be able to say something. But then we can't be putting it on women, because even women who are more resourced, well resourced, and well educated, are still unable to say that.
It's a tricky situation, because somebody, now that I know what I can advocate for and I know that it's my choice, I wouldn't go into a hospital unless I truly needed to have a hospital birth, because what can they offer me? I would be arguing with them all the time, and we would be having these conversations, because they don't seem to be able to do the informed consent part. They don't seem to be able to do the dance. And I think it might be a bit of a mixture of what you said with they think that sometimes they're the authority. Other times they're just so used to doing things a certain way, like their preference, obviously, because you are speaking to an obstetrician most of the time, or when I go in there, it makes it a tricky, difficult situation. And I was told that I was a square peg fitting in a round box or whatever, which means that I'm a very different woman that normally goes in there, because I've actually advocated for myself, which I suppose with the awareness of this coming out, women knowing and understanding the language, it does give women more voice and more power. And if more women are demanding it, we can then see change in the system, right? Because of consumer demand, mostly things change when we have the consumer demanding that. Otherwise, they're going to leave in droves and find something else. I have an awesome, amazing workshop coming up. And guess what? It's free. It's called Empowering Your VBAC. Are you curious or planning a VBAC? Of course you are, because you're listening to this podcast. And I'm guessing you want to learn as much as you can to give yourself the best chance at achieving your vaginal birth after C-section 2. Do you want to rock your VBAC and birth on your terms? If you said yes to any of the above, you are in the right place, and you'll be with kindred spirits in this workshop too. Come and join me live in this workshop, where we'll dive deep into the world of VBAC. You can also ask all of your questions on the workshop live. That's the beauty about coming. You can ask your personalized questions, and I can give you an individualized response. I can't wait to see you there. Check out the show notes, and I'll see you there live. Bye.
Absolutely. And we must also say, this is not what every woman is experiencing. And there are fantastic clinicians out there that are doing great. We found about around 1 in 10 women experience obstetric violence. It was about 28%, so just under 1 in 3 women, who experienced birth trauma, and mistreatment was high, up to 35%. However, that also means there's a lot of women either not identifying it, so potentially we've got a bit of a grey zone, a buffer on top of those of women who maybe they did but they haven't quite identified it, or they didn't want to, they chose not to identify it. And then on top of that, we've got some amazing models of care and amazing clinicians who are doing the right thing and who are, you know, using informed consent. But then there are pockets of women who are having worse experiences as well. So then we'll have those higher rates. And again, in the birth trauma study, we looked at the strengths and limitations across the different models of care. And we've got that paper is currently under review. And it was the analysis was done by a Fulbright scholar who came from the US to work with Hannah and I. And what we did with that is we asked women in the survey, you know, we asked them lots of open text questions. We had over 54,000 open text responses. And one of them was, do you have any other comments about your healthcare provider? And unsurprisingly, women had lots of comments about the healthcare provider. So we then, what we did is we analyzed them by model of care. So we could then, by model of care, look at what the strengths were and what the limitations were of each model of care. And using content analysis, which is qualitative but it has numbers, means we could then look at which models of care had the highest strengths and the highest limitations. And obviously the limitations are more negative, but I didn't want to put, like, you know, I kind of wanted to use language that would get us published, but also see more as a strength-based approach rather than you're all negative and you're doing shit. Trying to have that, I like that kind of strength-based approach. So the model of care that had the highest limitations and the lowest strengths was high-risk public maternity care, which I'm guessing, Ashley, is kind of where you would be put into.
Yes, that's where I am put into. And a lot of VBAC women going through the system as well.
And they identify it as limitations, because even though they're meant to be getting the best care because they're high risk, right?
Yeah.
They're actually getting substandard care. They may be seeing doctors only and no midwives. And this isn't a berating doctors, but midwives give a lot more information about pregnancy, labor and birth and education and support. And so instead they're having very short appointments with more junior doctors who are on rotating, so they're different every single time. You're having to tell your story every single time.
Yeah.
And it just feels counterproductive to what it is that you should be receiving. Now, we've got a few high-risk models across the country that have midwifery-led or midwifery involvement, which is fantastic, but that's not what most women were getting. So then, you know, you've got the lack of informed consent being, I guess, more obvious in that model of care, because there's this, well, there's something wrong with you. Like you're high risk, therefore we've got to take even more responsibility off you. And, you know, this just compounds things, where a lot of it potentially is more fear-based, risk-based than evidence-based. So there's certainly, there's certainly areas where we also need to focus on that. Other areas that we saw from our descriptive statistics that have higher rates of obstetric violence were our First Nations women, women from culturally and linguistically diverse backgrounds, and young parents, young mums, having much higher rates as well. So the groups that have more, there's more complications, or not complications, but there's other layers. There's more layers. So obviously, there's a systemic racism layer that comes in with our First Nations and women from cold backgrounds. But then there's also, a bit of a patronizing layer that comes on for, you know, young mums and the societal disagreement that young women should be having babies, and all that, those extra layers come out in the form of obstetric violence too.
Yes, I've heard that, especially with the young mums. It just rings so true that they get spoken over, they don't get treated like adults, that Yes, mini women. You know what I mean? It's like they're being treated as a mini version of us, rather than the woman that they are, which is a shame,
and,
isn't it?
And shamed, you know, shamed. But even if it's not the interesting thing, when we look at these comments from different groups, which we have been doing, we actually haven't really gone into the young women's one yet, but we will. And I started looking at them to put quotes together for our submission to the inquiry. But we have looked at women from migrant women who've come from non-English speaking countries. We've separated that group out to have a look at their comments, and we've looked at comments from First Nations women. And there's, especially from migrants from non-English speaking countries, there's not always the not always realizing that it could be due to their ethnicity or their background that something's happening. Because if you can't see a direct comparison, then how do you know? You might be feeling bad about what's happening to you, but if you can't see then that they came and treated me as a white woman, an English-speaking white woman, in a different way, how would you know that it's actually racism? Unless you can see really blatant. There was blatant racism when it came to First Nations women. So we've got a lot to work on as well. And obstetric violence has these extra layers on top. And certainly for young women, there's that layer of shame. But it's quite, you know, it's quite buried. It's buried in different types of behavior. And this is something that I'm particularly interested in and, you know, can't speak much on because we're still looking at that data. But it's how it's being displayed, but it's not as obvious, you know, because people know not to say really racist comments or you know, really nasty comments like, you know, you're only 18, you shouldn't be having a baby. Like, they might not say something like that, but they might then say or do something that is demonstrating it, but in a not so obvious way. And the same for women from different backgrounds, migrant backgrounds, and also First Nations women. It might not be so obvious, but there's just something that's done a little bit differently.
Yeah, it's so important to recognize and to hear as well. Were you saying that was from the birth inquiry that you were part of recently, or was that part of something
we
else?
Put a submission in as the birth experience study. We put a submission in to the birth inquiry, which is public. It's online. Anyone can download it and look at it. So we put that together. It's like 30 odd pages or something of data and infographics, really easy to read.
Wow.
We put in.
I'll have to grab that for the show notes then. So you were also doing the New South Wales birth inquiry. Is that the right title for it? Birth New South Wales.
So it's a New South Wales Upper House inquiry with a select committee. So it's with our different states and territories. This is a New South Wales government level inquiry, and it's the Upper House that have put together a select committee to do this inquiry. It was a very exciting time, although exciting also seems like, you know, kind of glorifies it, but it was, you know, the build up to this was kind of serendipitous. There was a lot of things that were going on. It was never just one person or one group. Mm-hmm. It was the fact that there was many things happening. You know, we had different consumer organizations that were doing work with women from different areas. There was a particularly strong one from Alternative Consumer Network who were working with women from Wagga, a group that were putting a group complaint to the HCCC. But at the same time, there were lots of other things happening. There's obviously a big body of research that has been there for a long time about why women choose birth outside the system, or why you know, birth trauma, all that kind of stuff. And then we also had our obstetric violence paper submitted, accepted to publication, so we were then able to kind of get into a conversation as well. And the other kind of serendipitous things that were happening was our consumer organizations were able to reach out to different politicians, and one in New South Wales showed interest, and that was Emma Hurst. she showed a real interest. She's actually got a background of being a psychologist, and she showed a real interest in this, both with the consumer group, so she gave them time, but she also met with us as researchers, and Barshi Hazard from Human Rights, who's a lawyer in human rights and childbirth, and we had a few meetings with Emma to kind of hash out what could be done from the government level. And then the paper did come out in December. That got a lot of media as well, and then a change of government. So we went from Liberal to Labour in New South Wales, the first time for many years. I used to remember how long it had been, but we had this change of government, which meant there were different ears listening as well. Now, Emma stayed there because Emma had a Senate post for eight years. So her position didn't change. But she was able to speak up to a different health minister, for example, people with different agendas. And then after mentioning it in the budget estimates this time last year, and then, you know, bringing it up again, there was the agreement that there should be an inquiry into this. So there's probably a whole lot of political stuff that I've got wrong here, because I am not a politician and I have no plans to be one. First of all, I'd have to give up my UK citizenship, which I have no, well, I do have problems with, because all my family live there. I'd need to be able to get back if I could. So there's probably a few things I've missed. But then when I got the phone call one morning from Tess, who works for Emma, to say, Hazel, oh my God, we got it. We got the inquiry. It's going to happen. The select committee's coming together. And Emma's was put as the chair of that select committee. I just thought, oh my gosh, what is happening now? Like, this is really exciting. I still thought it might still be low key. And, you know, I was hopeful that we would get some submissions, and I just hopeful we'd get enough that they thought it was important enough to look into, even though that was kind of a mute point anyway, because they were going to look into it because they'd agreed to a select committee. But then we had a few weeks, one of those included Birth Trauma Awareness Week, to encourage women to put in submissions. So there was a lot of media, and again, the consumer activist groups and the consumer groups were amazing at putting out social media, to talking to journalists. I did a fair bit of talking to journalists. I was on the project.
That's right, you were. I remember that that segment, actually. Yeah, there was a few women interviewed on that segment, and I just was like, oh my goodness, this is amazing. My husband sat there with me as we watched it, and I was like, thank goodness this is getting out. And also at the same time, totally devastating hearing those women's stories. But it's the stories that I hear and we hear on this podcast all the time.
Absolutely. So, yes, we had all that media, and then we had the submission closing date coming up. We got it extended because the site was down one weekend, so the select committee extended it for a few more days. We had another weekend. Then on the morning that it closed at midnight, and then the next morning I checked in with the wonderful women who organizing the whole inquiry. They're a really beautiful team, and they've done some really lovely stuff. Like, they've really, when a submission came in, especially if it was from an individual and it had maybe some identifying information, and maybe the woman didn't want, was happy for her name to go out, they would check in, they would contact that person and say, are you happy? Like, is this what you would like? They even did it for my submission. Is it under your name, Hazel, or is it under Western Sydney Union's name? And they've been absolutely amazing, working nonstop. And it's a small group of women on the inquiry. There's also in the select committee, the majority are women and only three men in the committee as well. And I found out that morning that there was over 4,000. They hadn't been able to fully count them all, but there was over 4,000, and they were having to go through them and upload them as they could. And then the hearings started. So the first day of the hearing was in Sydney, and it was mainly organisations So there were some consumer organisations, there were medical organisations, there was Han and I from the Birth Experience Study, and there was New South Wales Health in the afternoon, all public, all online. Apparently it's on YouTube. Like, it's all available. The transcripts are available.
Wow. Okay, I'll check that out.
Yeah, there was media there, and media articles obviously came out afterwards. And then the next one was a few days later in Wollongong, because there'd been a whole lot of inquiry submissions from the Illawarra. So they went down to Wollongong, and I was flying. Where was I flying from? I'd been at federal parliament that morning for a launch of the Friends of Maternity Care, which is a brand new thing. It was really exciting. And they mentioned the inquiry. So Jed Kearney actually mentioned the inquiry when she was doing her speech. Oh my God, that's happening right now. So then I was flying to Adelaide to go to the conferences. So I was trying to listen live to the hearing, as it was. It was really, really powerful. So it was women now sharing their stories. So for the morning, it was two groups of three women sharing their stories. I only managed to listen to the second one. I've got to listen to the full day. And they shared their stories of trauma, of loss, of violence, of everything. Then they had a midwife, Fiona Reid, who's done a lot of work in this space. They had Better Births at Illawarra, that is a fantastic consumer activist group. Again, they had a few other people, and then they did have New South Wales Health from the Illawarra, who started it with an apology of the women's experiences. So that was very powerful. So that's what's happened so far. There's two more days to go. There's going to be one in October next month in back in Sydney, and then they're going down to Wagga, where that group complaint came from. So they're going down to there in, I think that might be November or December. Then the select committee take all that evidence and all that information, and they bury away, and they work on it, and then they come out with recommendations. And that report of recommendations is due in February sometime. And then they put those recommendations to the health minister, and we see what kind of happens from there onwards. Be really interesting to see what those recommendations are going to be, obviously. But right now they're in the fact-finding mission of going through the submissions and listening to the hearings. So it's a big job, and they're doing it in a very trauma-informed way. And it's being watched all over the world. Like, CNN did a news article on it. So that was coming from the US. I've had contacts from the UK wanting to meet with me to ask me how they can put together an inquiry. People all over the world have been hearing about this and really interested in it, let alone across Australia. So it's from what I thought would be like, I hope we can make some kind of impact. We had this massive amount of submissions, and so I'm hopeful. Like, there's a lot of trauma, because it's the birth trauma inquiry. But I get spoken to a lot by obviously clinicians, especially at the last two conferences. I was like having my ear chewed off about it all the time. And they'd say, so, you know, they'd have concerns, you know, how's this going to impact these people, blah, blah. And they'd make some comments, and I'd be like, I would just remind them about the women and what was in it for the women. So I would say to them, okay, all these individual submissions, and most of them were individual submissions, these are women who are not doing it to get financial gain. They're not doing it as a complaint. They're not doing it to get any gain whatsoever. They're not doing it to get people into trouble. The whole reason they are doing it is to prevent further women experiencing this in the future. It is a pure altruistic act that they have done in sharing their story. Because the Select Committee cannot, and it's not in their jurisdiction, to follow up complaints, and they know that when they put their submissions in. They're purely doing it to make life better for more women, and that is really powerful for me. Whenever I think about that, it kind of like hits me, because I've read a lot of these submissions. We're downloading them and analyzing them as part of the birth experience study. And they're really hard. And it would have mean ripping open a wound to write it out and then submit it. And there's no gain for the woman for that. Like, she's then got to live with that until it heals back up again. She's purely doing it to make a difference for other women. That makes me, that is the hope that I hang on to, because that, I think that is so, so powerful.
So who were you actually telling that to, the committee?
No, I was, whenever I've been speaking to people and at conferences, and especially the last two. So, you know, I would get, you know, midwives, and actually one of the conferences was multidisciplinary. So I had lots of other psychologists and people working in perinatal mental health coming up to me and saying and asking me about, you know, the inquiry and what's the impact and what's the point and is it going to make any difference? And, you know, maybe there's some negative talk about it in their hospitals or in the units that they're working in, and they're worried, you know, they get caught up in that kind of negative language about it. And then that's what I would bring them back to. I'd go, but why are the women doing this in the first place?
Okay. That puts it into context. I'm wondering who you're having those conversations with. And that makes complete sense. And also how traumatizing, like re-traumatizing that can be for women, and how challenging. I had a chat with a couple of ladies who put the time and effort into sharing their stories, but they said it was a very challenging thing for them to have to do. It's not an easy process to relive through something that's traumatic or challenging or was negative or disappointing or whatever words that we put to those experiences.
Yeah.
I really hope that comes across for the people, that they can really feel how charged and how emotional that is for women. And I hope it really sits with them. And I really hope, I wanted to know, like, I don't have much trust in the government that things are going to change, but I do hope that there are some changes, and that's, and if anything, awareness, seeds, planting seeds and getting movements across the world, because this is something that can start so many other things, isn't it? It really is, with all of the other work that's going on. It's just like the snowball effect, you know. Have you heard of the snowball effect? Where, yes, it's just like getting momentum and capturing everything, and it really has to make a change.
Well, it's been that effect to even have it happen. And so then the ongoing impact of that, you know, I have to hold on to hope that it will do something. And, you know, sometimes people say to me, oh, but we had this thing, but we'd never had a birth trauma inquiry. You know, this is the first time for that. And there have been some threads that really kind of came out of those first 2 days of hearings. And in that first day, it was, you know, the thread of continuity of care with a midwife really came out. And on that second day, the thread of needing to have trauma-informed care, I think, really, really came out of that. And the thing I'm really impressed with the select committee is that they're looking at it with different eyes. Like, you know, I live in this space, you know, my husband's a research assistant on this project. We are living and breathing this every single day. And I've worked in the space, and I've worked through healing births as well. I've seen all that. So, but I still don't get shocked when I read, like, I still do get shocked when I read stories. I still get impacted by them. Yet these are people that are not, that all come from different backgrounds. And, you know, they're in their role to make change. And they've all got different lenses. They all wear different, you know, glasses with their own lenses of their own background or their party's background. Some of them are independent, some of them are in parties. But it's almost like they're looking at it through even like a child's eye of it. And some of the questions they might ask might be, we might think, isn't really suitable, or isn't, it's like, why the hell are you asking that question? But then they may have had nothing to do with maternity care other than maybe having a baby, or a friend having a baby, or a relative having a baby, or their partner having a baby. So they may have had nothing else to do with it before, and they're literally asking these questions, but they're seeing it through with fresh eyes. And I always think that has such a big impact, and potentially a positive impact, because maybe for those of us who are entrenched in it and listen to this all the time, maybe we do need someone to who can look at it and also understand the jurisdiction the government can have over things and what changes they can suggest, because they can't fix everything. And they are only focusing on preventative birth trauma, because they can't fix things that, you know, emergencies do happen, but it's like they're looking at the preventative things that can then cause it to be your traumatic incident. So I'm interested in the process that they're doing. I guess I'm a real head person to be, to at the end of the day, I'm interested in what's going on in their head and how they are then listening to this and being impacted by it and how that will then come out. But I've spoken to many of them, and I honestly think that, you know, their heart is in the right place. They really do want to just, they know it's a big problem, and want to look at the discrepancies and the things that are not working and potentially what is working and hearing everyone's voice on it. And I think that's been fascinating watching them do that. I don't get angry with any of the questions they might potentially ask, because I think they've got to ask them. And like someone said, oh, you know, you and Hannah were really grilled. I'm like, well, good that we were grilled, because our study is informing this so much that they really should grill it to make sure that, you know, it's actually a robust study, which it is. But others might want to, you know, disagree with that. And I'm okay with that. Yeah, grill it, because if we're informing something, then it's your job as government to grill that.
Yes, and it's interesting. It's good that they're asking questions, because it means they're interested and they're engaged and they're wanting to learn everything they possibly can. And I love that you're so open to being grilled and not seeing that as like a defense thing, that you know, that there's open communication and, you know, supporting the system, the process, so supporting the process. Well, that was a lot that we've just talked about, Hazel, and I really appreciate you sharing all of that. I've wanted to know the back end, like I'm a big picture kind of person, so getting a bit of the insight really, really helped me to understand the process and the powerfulness of all of this work that you've been doing and part of, and all of the different moving pieces that have been part of it as well. I will probably grab, if you've got any, you know, links and things, so the people listening can put, we can go to that, make it easy for anyone, because I know that a lot of the women listening, they will take the time to read a lot of it, and they will want to if they're in the right space. So that would be really cool.
We have the obstetric violence paper, but I will just, you know, want people to understand, obviously we've talked a lot about things that are quite triggering anyway, but that paper is quite hard to read from, not from an academic level. I don't write in academic language. I once had a journalist say to me when she read that paper, she's like, oh, Hazel, I'm so glad that you wrote it in everyday language. And I'm thinking, well, just because I don't have fancy words myself, but that's fine. I'm happy she liked it. So it's easy to read from that way, but it's not easy to read from a trauma point of view. There's a lot of language, and there is mention of sexual assault and physical assault. So just for your listeners to be aware of that before they go diving in, a cup of tea at a chocolate bar or whatever you need to get through those things. And we can also put our submission, obviously the submission that we submitted, because it's easily accessible online.
That'd be great. Thank you so much. Before you leave, is there anything you would like to share? Anything you want to share that's kind of happening in your world, or any offerings or anything happening?
Well, I mean, watch this space with the birth experience study. We have a paper that just came out last week on what women want, which is a really powerful paper of over 6,000 comments. From, we asked women what would they do differently next time, and there's a lot that they would do differently next time, so in the next pregnancy, that is. So have a look at that paper. Maybe we'll put a link to that one as well, and we've got more papers coming out, more that are under review, and we've actually grown. We're no longer an Australian study, and we are now an international collaboration that I'm leading with 12 countries across the globe who are now using our survey in their own context, and that includes high-income countries and low- to middle-income countries as well. Shout out to Indonesia, Zambia, and Somaliland. But then also we're in throughout Asia and throughout Europe as well, and South America. So it's what we're doing is like the power of the woman's voice. Not only is it Australia right now, but this will be an international data set of women's experiences of maternity care across the globe, which is so, so important. But I guess lastly, you know, there's a beautiful midwife who I know who's retired, writing books now, writing articles for us. And she's written this really beautiful article for the Practicing Midwife Australia, because she had experienced, I can't remember how many, but quite a few cesareans in her lifetime. She's now retired, her children are all grown up. Yeah. And then she read the obstetric violence paper, and we spoke about it as well, because we would see each other at events. And through that, reading it, she realized that's what she had experienced. She finally had words to the trauma that she'd been carrying for many, many, many years. And she then, at that deep, dark point of realizing that's what it was, she then went and got some help, some therapy, and she went through it. And she's now trained in that type of therapy to be able to support other women as well. And so, yes, the issue is big, it's deep, but it can also bring healing. And if she can do that in her retirement years, when her children are all grown up and she's a grandmother, and she was able to read that paper and go, oh my God, that's what happened to me, and then get help and then get growth through that time, then I think there's hope for every woman out there.
There's always hope, isn't there, Hazel?
Absolutely.
And that's what this whole podcast is about, isn't it? It's giving women hope of a VBAC or a VBAC home birth. And that's pretty much the space that I live in, hope and optimism as much as I possibly can, while teetering on the darkness of it all, because you've got to hold both, haven't you? The happiness and also the shadow side. So thank you so much for sharing everything with us. I really appreciate you as always.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me on.
Thank you so much for listening to the VBAC Home Birth Stories podcast. I hope this episode has helped you take another step forward in your VBAC home birth journey. If you enjoyed this episode, please take a second to rate and review. Each review helps me get this message out to more women just like us. Want to follow along and get freebies and offerings? Find me on Instagram, Ashley L. Winning, and send me a DM to say hi. And come and join our safe group on Facebook. Just search VBAC Home Birth Support Group. Until next time, keep shining beautiful.